Heather Yates is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Central Arkansas. She's the author of the recently published The Politics of Emotions, Candidates and Choices, out now from Palgrave Macmillan. Her particular areas of focus are political campaigns and elections. She's been researching voter behavior since the 2004 election, focused on emotions and how they influence voters' choice and even cognition. Heather Yates, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Many who voted for Hillary Clinton are pretty bothered by the disparity between the popular vote and the Electoral College. But in your analysis, you say this was actually only the fifth most contentious election in U.S. history. That can't be true.
It is actually true when we're taking a look at how the Electoral College functions. It's the fifth election where the winner of the presidency has not won the popular vote, but has won the threshold of 270 electoral votes to win the White House. So this has happened five times in the life of American democracy. Two of those in the last 16 years. The other three were in the 19th century.
And in the 19th century, were the ways that these elections were contentious and very, very close different from the ways they have been in the last 16 years, or pretty much the same?
Actually pretty much the same. If you take a look at the elections of 1876, 1888, and even 1896, the role of the media in the 19th century was very caustic. Maybe a smidge more than it is now. It was not living up to this romanticized standard of equal coverage, fair and balanced coverage, dispassionate coverage. No, it was vicious, it was personal, and it was committed to character assassination. Now, where we're at in 2016, voters and the viewing audience of the election saw both forms. They claim that they, you know, and voters overall claim that they're exhausted and fatigued with this type of journalism, but it seems to be everywhere we turn.
So one of the fallouts from this year's election is fake news. In your dissertation, you talk about effective intelligence. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that is, and does fake news fall into that?
Sure. So I think there's definitely a connection between effective intelligence, or basically what the emotive predisposition of the voter is, and what they are reacting to in terms of perception of information, political information, what have you. So effective intelligence is this idea of voters, just humans. Humans are emotive beings. We are emotional beings. And oftentimes in our cognition, there's a surveillance system in our mind, and there's also this emotive system, right, for the lack of a better term. And often people, humans, know what they feel about something before they can actually articulate what they think about it, right? So emotion is happening prior to cognition. And why is that important in political contexts? It's because, one, our brain is a machine of efficiency, and it's constantly probing the parameter for threats. And so when we're applying this to a political context, our brains don't understand really that this is just abstract concepts, political concepts. It's probing the perimeter for information that represents a threat to your status quo, to your survival. Now, this phenomenon of fake news, or these faux news sites that were circulating around on social media with headlines that were designed to be hyper-emotional, to appeal to the emotional senses of the reader, not the more cognitive side, the rational side, presenting both sides of the story, presenting fact, presenting verified fact, how long the list is, you know, of verified sources, named sources. And so what this did is created this strong bridge between the emotional voter and a saturated market of political information. In one sense, I think it could have created a hyper-emotional voter if this was the first election that a voter was paying attention to political news. The other category is it's reinforcing the emotive predisposition of certain voters. So a lot of fear. A lot of fear. You don't see the faux news headlines pandering to happy endings and human interest stories and let's come together and be good humans. It was your status quo, your subject position is threatened. Here's what is threatening it. And here's what we need to do about it. Here's the alternative. Here's the way you need to vote. And that's pretty much what we saw in a nutshell happening in 2016.
One of the interesting, I think, paradoxes that came out of this election is the notion, the theory, the hope, I think, for many folks, that what we're seeing is a destruction of identity politics. And it seems to comport with your line of study in terms of emotional voting. I mean, of course, we are, you know, the whole of our identities. At the same time, you talk about single issue voters. You talk about economic voters. I'm not sure that I personally would think of that as identity politics.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't think a single issue voter is in the same category is identity politics, because when we're talking about identity politics, we're talking about demographic profile, your socioeconomic status, the ethnic heritage we have, the neighborhoods we live in, the schools we went to, public versus private, right? Those all contribute to a compilation of an identity makeup. And I've also have been following the discussion post-election analysis on the destruction of identity politics. And I'm not sure that I'm completely convinced that it's the destruction of identity politics. I am convinced that there is a shift or a changing of identity politics in tandem or parallel with the conversation about electoral realignment, right? The base coalitions of partisan support for the Republicans and the Democrats are shifting right now. They are not stable coalitions. And I do think that does tie in with identity politics. So I think that there is some hopeful analysis out there. There's some hopeful hypothesizing that identity politics is going to be deconstructed in some fashion. I think at this point in time, from where I'm sitting, I certainly see it shifting. I don't see it completely imploding because voters rely on some form of identity, and so do candidates rely on appealing to identities. So sorry to those who believe that identity politics are going away. I am not convinced.
I think people who fancy themselves educated and intelligent think that they make their political choices based on information, based mm-hmm. on research. I'd put that in quotes. Mm-hmm. And that whoever the other side is, they're making their choices based on emotion.
Right.
What would you say to someone who thinks that?
So I love this question because this is a question I pose to my students, especially if it's usually the first week of my class. I ask students, so which one do you think you are? Are you a thinking voter or are you a feeling voter? Now, you can imagine all of their hands go up on the first one. Of course I'm a thinking voter, right? But within the last several years, they've gotten more savvy. They're like, oh, who are we kidding? We're totally feeling voters, right? But they explain that they understand the terrain of information is appealing to emotions, right? Sure, everybody wants to believe they're the thinking voter, right? I mean, that goes back to the roots of our civilization with Plato and Aristotle, right? We have thousands of years of the Western civilization canon privileging and romanticizing human rationale, human rationality. That's what makes us different in the animal kingdom, so to speak, and I'm referring to Plato, right? That humans are the rational animal, so to speak. So of course we need to be thinking human beings because that translates into responsible, informed, enlightened public policy. End of sentence, right? Whereas the feeling voter, that is what Plato warned us about, the mob rule. And that's what the framers warned us about, especially Thomas Jefferson and Hamilton, mob rule. So yes, so we have to stave that off and cling to this romanticized idea of the rational voter.
Because we are speaking in a studio in Little Rock here in Arkansas, the natural state, I have to bring this around to something at least somewhat statewide. In what ways do you think Arkansas as a voting block is maybe a lot like national trends? And in what ways are we an outlier?
So I've always adhered to the idea that if you want to make projections of what's going to happen at the federal level, watch the states. And I think there's a couple of ways that Arkansas has been very consistent with national trends, or regional trends, I should say. But also watch Arkansas to make projections down the road about what's going to happen at the federal level. I know that there's a lot of observation being made about the Arkansas's realignment after 2004 from being a Democratic stronghold to joining the southern region realignment of Republican leaning state. And I think that is it's definitely true. It's still being studied, it's being examined. It's not that Arkansas represented the Democratic platform the way that one would think that the national Democratic platform is. Ideologically, I think the state's been very consistent. And ideologically, Arkansas also supported one of its own native sons with the Clinton candidacy in the 90s. And that only changed, that only lasted, that lingered, what, two presidential elections afterwards in 2004. So that's also something very unique to Arkansas. I'd like to observe that Arkansas supports its own local talent. And Bill Clinton was local talent. And they were, and the state was loyal to local talent. So that's something that also Arkansas is very consistent on. My overall observation about Arkansas is that it is politically consistent. And so that's something to remain steadfast in. Now, in terms of, I'm not prepared yet to offer a conclusion about what contributed to the realignment in 2004. There's lots of different explanations out there floating about, and there's still ongoing research. Some theories that are floating about is that it was a direct response to the election of Barack Obama in 2008, of him, not even the election, but his nomination. And Arkansas realigned with the southern region and flipped to Republican, also within its congressional districts as well. Now, that is still being explored. More data is still being collected, because when we're studying realignments, we also have to examine the coalitions of support, right? The coalitions of support in Arkansas. Were these individuals who flipped from Democrat to Republican, did their ideologies flip? I would hypothesize no. Ideologically, the Arkansas voter is still very consistent. Because if we remember what the Southern Democratic bloc was through the 60s, 70s, 80s, into the 90s, ideologically still very consistent with what the Arkansas voter holds to be important now.
What do you mean by that?
So the Southern Democrats, you know, they have a spotty history, right? This is something that not a lot of voters would be proud to discuss, but the Southern Democrat bloc emerged out of the 1948 rift in the Democratic Party. I always remind my students and those I'm talking to is that, look, you know, each political party has had to battle its own factions. Right now, the Republican Party is battling its own internal faction with the Tea Party. Well, the Democrats had their own, and it was the Southern Democrats or the Dixiecrats. And the Dixiecrats broke off from the political party platform in 1948 because Harry Truman had introduced integration, public integration, racial integration to the party platform. And the Southern Bloc, the former Confederate states, walked out of that state convention. And they created kind of their own faction group, splinter group, that caused the National Democratic platform a headache for at least 20 years. And that's when we saw the emergence of the realignment in the Southern Bloc. Now, ideologically, the Dixiecrats and the Southern Democrats were based on political ideas that in 2016 are still, there's unsavory ideas. And this was also front and center in 2016 too, this contention and uneasiness still that persists about race in America and the legacy of race in America. Very uncomfortable history. And in the Southern Bloc, we see that the emergence of the Southern states to go Republican was initially driven by the splinter group of the Dixiecrats, okay? But that's also, I also want to be very clear with if painting the Southern voter is a dynamic voter. They're not single issue voters. That meaning in the 1960s, was race a driving component? Sure. But something else that I want to be very clear about the Southern voter is that it's not just race. I mean, this is about state autonomy, states' rights. And you talk to any Arkansas voter, race is not at the forefront of their political cognition, where it might have been 30 years ago, previous generation. And they'll be very open and upfront about that, about generations previously that had contentious views about what the political platform was in the 60s. But talking to voters in Arkansas and throughout the South, it's state autonomy, state control over its budget, the contentious federalism, you know, relationship between the state budget and the federal budget, public schools being tied to federal dollars. These are at the forefront of the Arkansas voter. And so ideologically, that was still very much the same in 2000 when George W. Bush was running for office, too. So I want to be very clear about what the historical motive was and what the current condition of the voter is. They're very dynamic, and they're in no way the same.
Can I just say that you're the first academic or expert who has ever uttered the words public school as any kind of like a wedge issue national right, elections.
Right. Who would have thought that public education would become a contentious issue? But this is why politics is so fascinating in my book. It always changes, creates the strangest bedfellows, meaning allies. And once upon a time, public education was the beacon of democratic society, and now it's framed as one of the problems of right. government, right?
Right.
And this is tied back to the notion of local control. You know, local school districts can determine what is best. And it's basically, you know, reversing the nationalization of public education curriculum and making it more localized. But yeah, I mean, this ball was set into motion probably in the late 90s, if not 2000, especially in 2000 when George W. Bush ran on the No Child Left Behind platform, which was ironic because it was calling for a nationalization of public curriculum from the party that prides local control. And that's not lost on voters either. They saw through that. They continue to see through that. It's an issue that they're very uneasy about voting for a candidate who just wants to run on that issue because it's trust. It's a trust issue, right? The Arkansas Republican wants to believe that the candidate running for office on the Republican platform really believes in local control of education. But, you know, they saw through the rhetoric of their previous standard bearer. So it is a contentious issue because some of them want local control. They want their local tax dollars to go to support their school. They want control over or at least have a say or influence over the curriculum in their classroom of what their child is getting exposure to. But yeah, who would have thought that education became this highly contentious issue on the same platitude as, you know, the moral issues, the other contentious wedge issues. So,
and this is like way far afield, but I love that of all the picks so far that Trump has made, including Ben Carson for HUD, the one, at least on my Facebook feed, that gets the most one is Betsy DeVos for Education Secretary.
Yeah. I've been seeing these as well. And, you know, here these last 4 weeks has paraded out a very interesting profile, but yet not surprising. With the election of Donald Trump as the next president, he is also promised to be unconventional. The whole time he has been unconventional. His rhetoric is unconventional. His behavior is unconventional, is that he's off script a lot of the times.
And I mean, his very candidacy is unconventional.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, if we want to go to the point of origin here, everything about Donald Trump has embraced the unconventional aspect of politics. He is he has been a true outsider. He has not held public office before. He's been a high-profile personality. But who he is pulling into his cabinets, and DeVos is one of them, has been the champion of what local-controlled school curriculum, school vouchers, charter school. And So this may be something that especially the Arkansas Republican voter might see as a win, you know, the hope that finally there is some local influence over education. Or the education curriculum, or what has been called a school choice, right? And this is really propelled by the fact that at the local level, there's been some consternation about the way dollars are spent on public school. And some schools are in desperate need of help. And voters are feeling like their concerns are lost on the ears of the people who have the most direct control. So the appointment of DeVos is probably heralded, and I know for a fact is heralded among many as victory, you know. And so we'll see the positioning is still needs to stabilize, but we'll see how this translates into actual policy. Like I said, 2 years will give us kind of an inkling on the satisfaction level of the Arkansas Republican voter, definitely nationally, but we'll see definitely in 4 years. And also something else that I want to say too is these individuals may not stay in their post for 4 years, right? They may stay for 2 years, 3 years, 1 year, you know, because there's also a lot of natural turnover in presidential cabinet. So we also want to remind our listening audience that there's a lot of turnover as well. So lots of variables out, but lots of posturing that gives Trump supporters some satisfaction right now.
You're an academic. Your work is ongoing. From this moment on, do you think the nature of the work that you do studying elections will shift any? Or do you think, no, this is all a continuation of the work I started in 10 years ago?
I think it's the latter. It's always going to be a continuation of the work that I started. It's an ongoing project. But what I'm looking for are places of consistency and places of shift. And when I'm looking at practices of consistency, the follow-up question is why? What is reinforcing this consistency? It's relatively stable. What variables are contributing to stabilization or stability? And then shifts or destabilization. What are the variables that are contributing to that? 2016 is most certainly going to stand out as a benchmark year. I've always had a joke. You know, every 4 years, somebody, you know, in my field feel like they become relevant. When things really destabilize, that's when we're really relevant. That's when people ask us what in the world just happened, and our answer is we're trying to figure that out too. So we're all kind of in the same boat. So yes, I love to look at it that way. It keeps things interesting, that's for sure.
Heather Yates is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Central Arkansas and the author most recently of The Politics of Emotions, Candidates and Choices. That's out now from Palgrave Macmillan. Heather, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been great.